You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. We read their quotes in Bloomberg Business and hear them talk about any number of tech and business-related podcasts, but sometimes it's hard to know what Silicon Valley executives are really thinking. Wonder what gets VMware CIO Bask Iyer out of bed each morning? Or what show its senior VP of sales can't stop watching? Tune in to the VMware Executive Perspective podcast series at vmware.com/radius/perspective to hear the whole story. Again, that's vmware.com/radius/perspective. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Folks, what's the craziest thing you've ever eaten? Chicken gizzards? Liver? Maybe a Rocky Mountain oyster on a dare once? Well, if you think you've got an adventurous palate, trust me, you've got nothing on my guest today. There's literally nothing that's edible that James Beard Award winner Andrew Zimmerman won't try at least once. For a dozen years now, he's traveled the world eating some of the most unusual foods, from blowfish to pig rectums to all manner of reproductive organs, for his travel program Bizarre Foods on the Travel Channel. The highly popular show has taken him to over 170 countries and led to a half dozen other shows for Andrew on the Travel Channel, including his latest, The Zimmern List, on which he shares some less exotic but beloved hidden gems in your favorite cities across America. Today, Andrew joins me to talk about how he became the man who'll eat anything and some of the most astounding bites he's sampled over the years. He reveals the strangest delicacies that turned out to be amazingly good, whether he's finally learned to love his old nemesis, the famously stinky durian fruit, and a couple of foods that even he absolutely hates. Spoiler alert, they're surprisingly boring. He'll discuss his broader mission to spread tolerance and understanding by showing Americans that no matter what we eat or how we eat it, the simple joy of sharing a meal is universal, and as he puts it, social change often starts with our stomachs. He recalls the inspiring story of how he went from living on the streets to globe-trotting on the Travel Channel. He explains why his newest show is his most personal one yet, and why he finally decided to share the one special restaurant that he swore he'd never reveal to the public. Plus, why freshness matters when eating testicles, the best bird fetus you ever ate, and two words, snake wine. Coming up with the Travel Channel's Andrew Zimmern in just a moment. Four-time James Beard Award-winning TV personality, chef, writer, and teacher, Andrew Zimmern is the creator, executive producer, and host of the Bizarre Foods franchise on Travel Channel, including Bizarre Foods, Bizarre World, Bizarre Foods America, and Bizarre Foods Delicious Destinations, as well as Andrew Zimmern's Driven by Food, and now his latest show, The Zimmern List, which airs Tuesdays at 9 Eastern, 8 Central on the Travel Channel. Andrew, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thrilled.
Before we get into it, how many times do people mess up your name?
all the time.
Yeah.
Which doesn't bother me at all, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. The funniest kind of...
Because it's not Zimmerman.
No,
it's Zimmern.
And it's Zimmern, and it's hard to say, and a lot of people pronounce it Zimmern, which is truly strange to me. But the funniest thing is I often get stopped on the street and people shout out at me, "Hey, Anthony Zimmern," which is really funny because Tony's much taller than I am.
Oh, okay, they're conflating Anthony Bourdain. I love it. Well, I'm a big fan of the Bizarre Foods franchise and your newer shows. You've made a name on the Travel Channel with your signature series, Bizarre Foods, which is kind of a hybrid of travel, food show, and high school dare. How did you come up with the idea for that original show?
I was cooking in a restaurant that I co-owned in Minneapolis, and I was, oh gosh, I don't know, it was 20 years ago. I was 6 or 7 years sober, and my life seemed to be changing every minute. And I noticed that while I was working on concepts for my personal wellness around patience, tolerance, and understanding, it struck me one day reading the newspaper that the world was beginning to define itself by our differences, sexuality, religion, right. Music, sure. Skin color, yeah. In a louder and louder voice.
Mm-hmm. And not in a helpful way.
Not quite the opposite. And I had always been involved in food since I was a child. And it seemed to me that one of the things that might be helpful would be looking at culture through food, using culinary as a prism, and that we would be discussing things that we all had in common. You know, if you sit around a dinner table in Indonesia or Africa or South America or, Cleveland, the dinner scene is so familiar to everyone, regardless of the circumstances, what's on the plate, the class, the gender. Dinner is dinner. And it was a really big sort of mind blower for me. And I immediately set about deciding, because I've always been in search of a larger audience for the messages that I feel like I'm skilled at delivering. And so I decided to create a show that could do for people, remind them that the things we have in common are much stronger and much more important than the things that separate us. Now, that's an extremely lofty idea. It's cerebral, and it is not the kind of thing that you would see on commercial
for Bizarre Foods
cable. where you see a lot of entertainment shows and a lot of things that are meant to be something that folks can sort of relax on the couch and forget about the problems of the world. Well, I wanted to challenge that idea. I didn't believe that idea was true. And so I kind of developed what I called a Trojan horse, which was I started shopping around this idea of the show, Bizarre Foods. And the hook was foods from the fringe, stories that people hadn't heard about. And because who wants to tell another story about a chicken breast or a hamburger?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody else is doing that. What a waste of time. And I felt that by having that hook, which was entertaining and new for people, that I could slowly weave in more and more education and more, intellectual heft. Now, what has happened over the course of it took me a while to sell the show, but over the last 12 years that it's been on, it's kind of been a tentpole for that kind of greater understanding of people. And, I like to have fun. I think I'm funny in the show. I think the show is fun to watch. But there's an earnest seriousness beneath it all. And I'm just so extremely proud of the fact that, the world, it airs in 80 countries. And now that Travel Channel has been bought again by Discovery, it used to be part of Discovery when I first started there, it's going to have an even larger audience. So I'm humbled by that whole experience.
There is a certain genius to that idea, because if you're trying to get particularly, let's say, Americans who can be somewhat xenophobic and afraid to travel and to try new things, what better than to start with the thing they're probably most afraid of, which is the kooky foods that I might come across in Asia or Africa.
And what to them are kooky people. I mean, the food looks different, but the people and the settings look different. Yeah. The one thing that I knew, and that's interesting, and I love the way you phrased that comment, is that people in America absorb other cultures first through their mouths.
You're right.
We love Mexican food. I mean, yeah. I've had great Mexican food in Alaska, down to Florida, from Maine to Southern California, from North Dakota to Texas, right? There's great Mexican food everywhere.
True.
And yet the jury is out in this country, sadly, on you know, Mexican music, Mexican dance, Mexican art. And the jury is even further out in this country, most shockingly and appallingly and, to me, alarmingly and sickeningly, about Mexican people. Mm-hmm. People are people all around the world. The greatest gift that I've received over the last 12 years of circumnavigating the globe dozens of times and, you know, visiting 174 countries over the course of my lifetime is that people are generally fabulous everywhere.
Yeah.
And we have so much in common. And if we could just open our eyes a little bit to the fact that, you know, and that's what's great about TV is that it shows you. It doesn't tell you. You're not reading it. It actually shows you. So people who aren't even paying attention to the words can actually see what I'm doing. And hopefully we can make the world a better place through it.
Yeah, I love what you said about how we begin to accept other cultures through our mouths. Mm-hmm. At one point, there was a time when Italians were the hated other in America, and then everyone started eating Italian food. And I mean, I don't know how the Irish came to be accepted then, because I mean, I'm trying to think of the last time I had a good Irish meal.
You know, it's fascinating. There is great Irish food and there is great Italian food, and I think once people taste it, it's quite amazing. I mean, I'll even, you know, I mean, you know, fermented seafood from Korea. Or the Scandinavian countries, when it's put down in front of people and shared the right way, under the right circumstances, people's eyes are opened to it in a really fascinating way. Now, at the same time, very luckily, I call it the Food Network generation had emerged and was growing up. So people in this country started to become more and more interested in food, more and more interested in other foods.
Yeah.
And I think that became the luck, the timing. I mean, everything successful in the world, you know, from Henry Ford up to Elon Musk, has really been an issue of timing. And I was very lucky that the timing of my show sort of was right at the peak of our new obsession with cuisine, and people wanted to see something other than a shiny floor show with a talking head standing behind a cutting board making another lemon meringue pie.
Now, for anyone who's never actually seen the show, if those people exist, give us a few examples of some of the more unusual foods you've ingested over the years. Over, I think 15 years now, right?
Well, it's been
in 170 countries.
It's been this is the 12th year the show has been on.
Oh, okay.
Bizarre foods, and I've made, I mean, hundreds. And hundreds, I've probably made 1,000 hours of television for Travel Channel with all my different series, and one series with Food Network called All Star Academy. The Dr. Seuss foods are the ones that I think are almost the most surprising to people. The offal, you know, from animals, which is something that we've eaten since we first, you know, had caves and built fire. But the Dr. Seuss foods are really unusual. You know, we were in Samoa, and once every decade or so, the atmospheric conditions are right deep out at sea, thousands and thousands and thousands of feet underneath the surface. If the ocean gets still enough and there's no wind, which is rare, and the sun is beating down on the ocean, it signals the coral to release a worm, a blue worm called Pololo, that rises to the surface of the ocean where it dies in the sunlight and then sinks back down to you know, fertilize the coral for another generation of this worm. And it's just the cycle sounding. Of the coral bed. And the natives go out there and harvest it with thin nets,
really?
And then eat it raw or cook it. And, you know, it's the type of food that I ate once and I'll never even see again in my lifetime.
Well, especially with the coral reefs now.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I've been, you know, with tribal communities, you know, of the dozens of protected tribes around the world, I think I've made more TV. I know I've made more TV with more of them than anyone else on the planet. And you see bushmeat and other tribal delicacies coming out of the jungles and deserts where and river systems where these peoples are secreted away. Mm-hmm. And you see, you know, species of birds, species mm-hmm. of fish, species of, you know, fruits and vegetables that aren't available or seen anywhere yeah. else in the world. And that just constantly blows my mind.
Yeah. Now, what is something that probably sounded completely repulsive to you and you told the crew, you know, keep the Pepto or a barf bag on standby and you were just completely amazed once you tried it?
You know, believe it or not, it was the first time I tried tiny little birds. Whether
is this
it was
the Ortolan?
Well, Ortolan are Ortolan? Famously banned in France now,
right.
But I will admit I have been a guest at, not on camera, at some of the several quote unquote secret yeah. societies that still enjoy them. But you know, when someone presents you with you know, a tiny, small, little cooked bird and says, hold the beak and eat all the rest of it, you're kind of surprised. We've done a lot of different types of birds on the show, the most prominent being in Vietnam and Thailand, where in some very rural communities, they'll give you five or six birds, sometimes ducklings, sometimes uh-huh. little chicks, sometimes just wild sparrows, and the feathers are off, they're marinated, they're deep fried, you eat the whole thing, and they're just absolutely delicious, probably the most delicious taste of that poultry that you'll ever have. But it set me up really well for the first time I visited the Philippines 14 years ago and started to eat balut, which uh-huh. are the fertilized eggs that have the fetus inside of them.
Oh, wow.
They're hard boiled or steamed and then served with vinegar and salt for dipping, and they take a little getting used to, but they're phenomenally delicious. That was one that I was, wow, I don't think I'm gonna like this, but it turned out I really and truly did. And usually that the grandparents' admonition, you know, try it a couple times before you
right.
give us an opinion, is definitely true for me. Mm-hmm. There are foods like that balut that I thought the first time, it's okay. Second time I was like, it's good. Third time I was hooked, and now
really?
Anytime there's a good balutan,
oh, yeah.
well, freshness counts with them.
Right,
I hate
right.
to say
I'm
it.
Sure,
so, you
yeah.
know, you don't just walk in anywhere and start eating them, but a good balutan, a place that raises the eggs and serves them at 14 to 17 days old, you know, right in the sweet spot, so there's not too many feathers on the little bird inside the egg. They're pretty darn delicious.
Now, on the other hand,
as I'm saying that, it sounds ridiculous.
in theory, it does.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the other hand, you've had this long-standing struggle with this notorious nemesis of yours, the durian fruit.
Yeah.
After all these years, have you eventually started to come around to appreciate it on some level?
Oh, I've always appreciated it because
oh, okay.
there's so many people who adore it. Mm-hmm. I just don't care for it at all.
Oh, okay.
I was a guest at the Indonesian embassy in Washington, D.C. many years ago, and they actually had durian 10 different ways
uh-huh.
in an effort to kind of find a way that I would love it since it's so adored over there. And the chef made a sambal with, you know, a hot chili sauce with fermented durian that, which is odd because durian
is it better
tastes
fermented?
So, to me, it tastes so rotted
yeah.
that fermented, I really couldn't understand it. But it was absolutely phenomenal,
no
and I slathered it on this barbecue baby duck, these Bobby Gooling that they were
yeah.
serving. So I have found a way that I do enjoy it,
huh.
and I defend anybody else's right to enjoy it. I don't care for it, and durian comes, you know, into season in the Southern Asian islands and Southern Asia at the same time that so many other amazing fruits come
oh,
into
yeah.
season.
The fruit
like,
bounty's incredible.
Why would I want to waste my yeah. stomach space?
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah.
I know you get asked this all the time, but what is the one thing that you just couldn't stomach? Has there been one of those?
You know, this is fascinating. You're the first person, you know, this is a scoop.
Uh-huh.
ever since I was a little child, I've hated walnuts. I just haven't been able to eat them.
Is it an allergy thing?
No, soapy, mealy. I just can't stand this. As I'm chewing them, the smell that comes up through my nose, mm-hmm. I really almost have to spit them out. I just can't handle it. And people like you laugh because, you know, the other things that I so willingly eat and so obviously enjoy on the show. And I just got back from a trip to San Sebastian, and Elena Arzak, very famous chef, knew that I disliked walnuts. And she had a local farmer who she gets her walnuts from. Yeah. Set aside a batch of these incredible walnuts from coastal Spain. Yeah. And I ate some, and they are phenomenal, and okay. I couldn't stop eating them.
Really?
And so now at least I can say that walnuts from southern Spain okay. to me are quite delicious. I don't eat oatmeal, cooked oatmeal, but okay. I love oatmeal cookies.
Interesting.
I don't eat raw cookie dough. Uh-huh. I can't stand the taste of raw flour. It just grosses me out. So I guess basically we're down to raw oatmeal, cooked oatmeal and raw cookie dough is it.
Okay, so but far. No problem with testicles.
Nope.
How many different forms of testicle have you consumed on this show?
Probably about, I've eaten the genitalia.
Yeah, okay, yeah, let's broaden it. Yeah.
Probably 60 or 70 different animals over the course of that. I mean, any animal that has a yeah. ball or a penis, yeah. it's, you know, and it's around, I end up eating. But what's I don't do it gratuitously in the sense that I don't seek it out. I do it in places, you know, the culture, they eat all of the animal right. and they've found a way to prepare mm-hmm. them. Now, I know it's going to sound funny, but if you talk about freshness counting with something,
yeah.
there are certain foods that notoriously start to go bad almost instantly once the animal's life or the body part is separated from the animal.
Okay.
Testicles are one of them. Just like skate wings become more ammoniated
I've heard that.
The further yeah. from, you know, dispatching the animal goes. Fresh. Everyone would love them. The problem is that most testicles, you know, people eat them at county fairs and stuff where they're frozen. Mm-hmm. Because yeah. you remember, the testicles from cows come from being snipped
yeah.
during certain times of the season when the cows okay. are young enough.
Right.
So that yeah. thousands of tons of them are frozen every year.
Uh-huh.
Then they're trimmed and sliced. Uh-huh. Then they're breaded or battered. Then they're frozen again. And then they're deep fried at the carnival mm-hmm. or the, you know, food booth or yeah. the stadium. And you're eating one of the best pieces of food at its absolute worst. Commercial product, yeah. 3 years old, frozen twice.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Andrew Zimmern when we come back in just a moment. The most successful business owners I know are people who enjoy what they're doing. Whatever their thing is, they love it. But here's what they don't love. When they have to stop doing what makes them money to handle something that doesn't. That's especially true when it comes to email, and that's one reason why AppRiver shines. AppRiver keeps your inbox free from spam and viruses, so you don't have to worry about all that junk cluttering up your day. If you're running your own email servers, protect them with AppRiver. Or if you're tired of that headache, just sign up for a hosted Exchange or Office 365 and get your email from the cloud. Here's the best part. Call AppRiver anytime, night or day, and you'll talk to a real, live, U.S.-based company employee. Somebody who's trained to take care of your issue and let you get back to doing what you love. Visit appriver.com/kickass and try any of their services for free. That's appriver.com/kickass. Looking to move to the cloud? Don't know where to begin? Check out the Google Cloud Platform weekly podcast, where Google developer advocates Melanie Warrick and Mark Mandel answer questions, get in the weeds, and talk to GCP teams, customers, and partners about best practices. From security to machine learning and more, hear from technologists all across Google about trends and cool things happening with our technology. Click to learn more and subscribe to the podcast at g.co/GCP podcast. Again, that's g.co/GCP podcast. Z-Quiet is a revolutionary anti-snoring product created out of one family's need for peace and quiet. Dan and Trina Webster were desperate for a solution for Dan's snoring. That personal desperation led to a simple solution to a problem shared by millions of Americans, Z-Quiet. Made in the USA using soft BPA-free material, Z-Quiet is a comfortable, easy-to-use mouthpiece that's been helping snorers and their bed partners for 10 years. Just pop it in when you go to bed, and it works immediately. You can talk and even drink while wearing Z-Quiet because it works on the simple principle of moving the lower jaw slightly forward to open the airway and prevent vibrations that create snoring noise. Try it with confidence thanks to their 30-night better sleep guarantee and feel good about your purchase knowing that Z-Quiet gives back. I didn't think that I snored, but I remembered that that's why I was sleeping on my side because whenever I sleep on my back, I snore. Turns out it's much healthier to sleep on your back, so I decided to give it a try again. And when I did, I put in my Z-Quiet mouthpiece. No snoring, no discomfort, just a quiet, peaceful sleep straight through the night. Kick snoring out of bed. Sleep quiet with Z-Quiet. Z-Quiet is so confident that you'll be satisfied with the results that they're letting my listeners try Z-Quiet risk-free for 30 days for just $9.95. Just go to tryzquiet.com. Again, that's tryzquiet.com. And you can try Z-Quiet risk-free for 30 days for just $9.95. You have nothing to lose except quiet, restful sleep. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you run your business from your cell phone while keeping your business and personal lives separate. Choose from their huge inventory of local, toll-free, and vanity toll-free numbers. Simply forward your new number to your mobile phone and start taking calls immediately. Whether you're in an office, in your car, or out shopping, Grasshopper's iPhone and Android apps help you stay connected to your customers. Not to mention, you can send and receive calls and texts from your business phone number, set up multiple extensions for everyone on your team, get your voicemails transcribed and emailed to you, work from anywhere with call forwarding, make and receive calls from your computer via the desktop app, and even utilize Wi-Fi calling. Better yet, Grasshopper offers easy and instant setup and 24/7 customer support, all without any long-term contracts. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. And now, back to the show.
You know, Americans, we eat the filet and we throw out 95% of an animal. Yeah. I don't think that most people realize that's not how the rest of the world works usually.
Or how
and
this
it's not
world,
how we used to.
Exactly.
In many ways.
You're spot on.
I mean, everywhere else goes literally whole hog.
Mm-hmm. Historically, 3-4 generations ago, when we ate all of an animal and we ate little fish with the heads on it and we ate foods that would be considered throwaway varietals today in terms of vegetables and fruits. You know, my great-grandmother never threw away a bruised piece of fruit.
Really?
It was indistinguishable between, you know, bruised and pristine in the market. They were all dumped into the same bin.
Yeah.
You know, nowadays we have to have a movement built around these foods to get people to try them and enjoy them.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, the home arts movement has meant that a lot of people are now preaching, hey, take your bruised tomatoes and your bruised fruit and make plums and jams and make jams and sauces and things out of them.
Yeah.
But quite frankly, a lot of those things that look less appetizing are actually more appetizing.
Right. They maybe take longer, delicious. Though. You have to smoke them.
How many times have we seen a tomato in a supermarket and it tastes like an orange tennis ball because it was plucked green, it was, you know, gassed to turn color. And I mean, you know, the modern supermarket in many cases was a huge boon to American culture during the, you know, decades that it became a neighborhood staple, but the American supermarket has also been our downfall.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to meat, prepackaged small portions of pieces that could be cooked quickly, those are all luxury cuts, right? You know, a pork chop can be seared in 10 minutes on the stovetop. A steak, same thing. Mm-hmm. But it takes real artistry, and it takes time, and it takes education mm-hmm. to know how to cook oxtails or brisket yeah. or lamb shanks
right.
or goat's necks.
Which were all the slave food that became barbecue, right?
Well,
in some cases.
Yeah. I mean, it's a generalized term. But yeah, you know, once, you know, in the 19th century, early 19th century, at the height of the slave culture in the South, where white people of privilege would eat one type of food and anything that they didn't use was given over to others, you know, to eat the, you know, kitchen scraps, you know, is a, you know, a bellwether of a horrible time in mm-hmm. our country's history. What's ironic to me and a fascinating piece of modern culture is that, you know, while the American Steakhouse is still a great exemplar of popularity for dining culture in America, the hottest culture right now, and I think the truest form of American food, is the cuisine of the South, mm-hmm. born out of the slave culture, influenced by native and indigenous tribes like the Taino all throughout the Caribbean, yeah. Amerindians yeah. in right. Coastal Central America, and has developed into this modern Southern cuisine where all of those parts mm-hmm. are gratefully eaten. Great chefs, you know, like, you know, Sean Brock and, you know, Tandy Wilson and Mike Law, these great Ashley mm-hmm. Christian, all these amazing chefs in the South. I could go on and name dozens and dozens. It's horrible that I just grabbed four and now all my other friends. What about me? You know, John Kearns, all these people yeah. have been espousing a different way of looking at all these things. And is there a more coveted side with your barbecue than collard greens? But that was something True. that came out of the African experience. You know, when those foods were given, that cucina povera, as the Italians call it, you know, the foods born of necessity, the foods of the impoverished, the foods of the less fortunate, those required real cooking to mm-hmm. transform them into something oh, yeah. delicious. But that's what's so appreciated now.
Yeah.
And it's not that anyone can cook a brisket, but, you know, I kind of use the fried chicken thing as an example. Everyone raves about fried chicken. It's like, look, it ain't that hard. Start with a good bird, you know, dredge it in buttermilk, you know, flour, salt, and pepper, and fry it right. Mm-hmm. And you're gonna get an A. But it's all of those wonderful sides. It's what can you do with butter beans? What can you do yeah. with the tops of greens? You know, what can you do with, you know, livers and gizzards and shanks and oxtails? And quite frankly, now people are lining up at the meat and threes in the South that for, you know, were running on fumes mm-hmm. for decades yeah. as people were trying to eat children's portions designed by interior decorators. Now that food is out. And, you know, I mean, just look at the popularity mm-hmm. in Appalachian food that's coming back in, which is our own country's cucina povera. It's an amazing turnaround, and I'm really proud that in some small way, because, you know, TV is giving me a very large platform, that, you know, I've been a part of helping people to recognize that those foods are important and delicious.
Mm-hmm. You've had an incredible and inspiring personal story. At one point, I believe you spent a year living on the streets. I wonder, has that experience informed your appreciation for these cultures that don't just throw away everything, that don't waste food? I mean, a man who's living on the streets probably doesn't refuse a whole hell of a lot, does he?
I would not be doing what I do right now if I hadn't almost died on the streets as a drug addict and alcoholic.
Wow.
You know, my fall, you know, led to me squatting an abandoned building in Lower Manhattan, trying to drink myself to death every day, stealing, you know, to get money for food and supplies. I was a user of people and a taker of things. And I spent many nights and days taking, you know, beds where I could at the Salvation Army for a night just to get warm, or meals from soup kitchens. And living that life and then having a series of experiences that got me on the path to sobriety, and now being continuously sober. You know, I'm into my 27th year of sobriety, which is shocking. I've never done anything for 27 years except breathe. it is is the reason why I do my work. Mm-hmm. You know, at the beginning when I talked about that idea and looking at the world and, you know, working on myself and trying to practice certain spiritual principles of, you know, patience, tolerance, and understanding with other people is something that I learned to help keep myself healthy and sober, mm-hmm. and right-sized and right-thinking. And it wasn't equating with the world that I was seeing in my food life. And so I still loved my food life. I wanted to stay in a food life. I wanted to work in the food business, but I realized I needed to change what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And so it's a direct correlation. And quite honestly, you know, it's not just that it gave me an appreciation for other cultures, but surviving the worst parts of my bottom before I got sober has given me an appreciation for other cultures and other people in a way that had I not experienced it, I wouldn't have.
Yeah. I have to wonder then, is sobriety difficult when you're doing this show and people are having you into their home and you're trying all these unusual types of food and they probably offer you sake or whatever? It's not hard. Is that ever delicate?
The fact of the matter is, at a certain point, you kind of are more firmly on the path. It doesn't mean that I'm still at arm's length away from a drink, but it's easier to choose not to. When I go into other homes, you know, and somebody offers me something, I just, you know, in other cultures where they don't understand alcoholism or drug addiction, I just simply say I'm allergic and I can't. People are very, very understanding. Now, famously in a Russian banya in Dallas, I was with an owner of this bathhouse and we had shared an entire morning together. And in a very comical situation, he kept putting shots of vodka in front of me and he kept saying, you know, vodka. And I kept saying, yet. And he goes, vodka, yet. And, you know, we were laughing hysterically. But they understand alcoholism very well in Russia. And I just looked at him and I said, dude, I'm a sober alcoholic. And he just looked at me, his eyes widened as if I was the devil. Because clearly he'd considered, I guess at some point in the past, that maybe he wanted to quit drinking. But no, it's really, it's never been a problem for me at all. In fact, the only thing... it was the pilot for Bizarre Foods. I was offered a glass of snake wine in a
The hell is that?
It's a wine that's infused with a dead snake. It's really awful stuff. I was given a glass at the end of the meal, and rather than insult my hosts, I raised it to my lips and pretended to drink it. And I realized when I went home that night that I was being dishonest with myself and dishonest with them. And it was more importantly that I was dishonest with myself. Yeah. And I swore I would never do that again, and I never have. And it's funny because whenever it airs, I get tons of people, you know, texting me like, did you pretend to drink that? And I was just like, yeah, and I don't do that. You know, it's like, it was, you know, So there have been lots of changes and lots of things that I no longer do. But sipping that snake wine was, or putting it to my lips rather, was, and pretending to drink it was one of the more comical things for me. I'll just never forget the thought processes. But that's typically something that people go through when they're doing things that are a first. You know, we were shooting the pilot of the show. I didn't know how I would handle every situation on camera.
Yeah, it gives new meaning to the phrase, choose your poison, I guess.
That's exactly right.
Well, you now have a new show where you're sharing some of your favorite hidden gems in different cities for your new show, The Zimmern List. I read you say that this is the most personal show that you've ever done. Why is that?
Well, it's personal on five or six different levels, mm-hmm. and so that's how I've been describing it. First of all, my production company, Intuitive Content, is producing it. So, you know, that's, and you know, we've produced other shows. We produced Driven by Food. Mm-hmm. We've done shows for other people and are continuing to grow. It's really exciting being an entrepreneur in the TV space. And I'm really proud of our whole team at Intuitive. I think it's the best linear production company in food and travel TV around, but I'm biased. So that's personal. Second thing is that it involves a lot of personal choices for me because I'm doing things in the show that I would do if the cameras weren't there.
Really?
All like the time.
What do you mean? Are you talking about in terms of places you go?
Where or? I go, what I choose to eat, who I choose to hang out with, stuff like that.
Okay.
It's not like every guest in the show or every food place is one that, you know, I ring up the guy, you know. But, you know, in our Austin episode, my friend Rennie Ortiz has a new place here, you know, that in Austin, Fresa, and... You know, I've known him for a long time. And so whenever I come into town, if he has a new place, I always go and visit him, you know, because he's my friend. And so obviously I was going to do that. You know, I've been friends with Aaron Franklin for a long time. And it going to visit him is something that I do.
Yeah. Okay.
And people, you know, were like, well, so we can't do another episode with, you know, at Franklin Barbecue. I'm like, but that's what I do when I'm in Austin. So yeah. The challenge for me as a TV producer and a production company owner is, what am I going to do differently with that scene?
Yeah.
So what we've done from a stylistic standpoint, and another reason it's so personal to me, is that it's shot very close up. I can't stand wallpaper on food and travel television. I mean, enough with the vista. I get it. You know, Rome's a beautiful city.
So this is all about the food.
You know, but I don't want to be filled up with, in a 22-minute total running time in a half-hour show, with 18 minutes of pictures of statues. I can, you know, go online and look at that. I want to see a story. I want to see a story.
Yeah.
So it's shot very personally. We use prime lensing. We use very little VO. We use a lot of natural sound. Now, those are all things that are eschewed in most lifestyle TV programming on cable. Most people don't notice it.
Yeah.
Most people don't notice it.
Yeah.
But a lot of television networks have rules about that kind of stuff. Because they want their network to have a certain look and feel.
Yeah.
And I'm super grateful that I get to work for a network like Travel Channel, that while they have rules, they were willing to break some of them to allow us to experiment with this. Yeah. And I think we kind of respect the viewer enough for them to understand brisket comes from a cow. You don't need to see me opening every door to know how I got into the room.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little less produced, more authentic, you would say?
It's, you know, some people have, you know, referred to that as, you know, more verite style.
Right, okay.
And I think that's kind of the wrong word. I mean, it's the right idea, but it's the wrong word. We're just trying to keep it real, and we're not, you know, we're not talking down to the viewer. The viewer is smarter than I think a lot of people think they are.
Oh, what are some of the other destinations you're going to hit this season?
Well, we did Austin, we did Los Angeles, we did New York, Minneapolis, Portland, San Diego, San Francisco, Chicago.
Okay.
Where I'm blanking a bunch of other 18 fantastic cities around the country.
Now, I heard that in the San Francisco episode, you take viewers to a place that you swore you would never reveal.
That's correct.
Because you were afraid that it would become too popular, or what?
Yes. Here, it's a funny thing. I was at a noodle shop in Singapore, and I went and I shot a show there the same year Bourdain was doing a different show than he is now, and he was doing No Reservations. He had shot there as well, and the owner said that, you know, neither episode, the Tony's episode hadn't aired and mine was obviously just being shot, and he said, you know, oh yeah, maybe, you know, a couple extra people will show up. Ha 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 ha. So about 4 years later, I'm back on vacation, you know, on my time. And I'm with some friends. I'm like, oh, we got to go to this place. And we go, and there is a line down the block. And I walked up to the front of it and stuck my head in the door. And, you know, there's the kindly little lady who had owned the shop, and she's just hustling, and, you know, she it was her and her daughter, and now there's like six employees. There's someone else in the front, like, managing the crowds.
Oh,
and
no.
She looked at me, and she jokingly said, "You two ruined this for my family." And I started to actually talk to her about it, and she, you know, she said, "Look, I'm, you know, business is great. It's wonderful. You know, so I'm half kidding, but I'm half serious, because now it takes so much energy to manage this business because you've made it, yeah. you guys have made it so popular. Everyone circles it. So everybody who comes yeah. has to go check it out.
Yeah, you complicated her life there.
So, exactly. Now, on the flip side of that, I've walked in, there's a place in I think it's in Birmingham called Eagles, and it's a meet and three place. And it was out of business. It was dead. They just didn't know it yet. They were serving a handful of customers. They used to do 300 customers a day because they were in the shadow of a big factory down there. And so breakfast, lunch, and then after shift, all the factory workers would come. And for 50 years, it was one of the more popular little tucked away secret neighborhood eateries. Well, we walked in, and they didn't have a customer the whole day. When we were there.
No kidding. Yeah. Wow. The whole day.
And the whole day. And the factory went out of business and the neighborhood, became more famous for, drugs and violence than anything else. Well, we highlighted in the show because the people who cook there have a God's gift. I mean, it was some of the most delicious food I've eaten in a long time. And when I went back there 2 years later, there's a line down the street. And
good
they came out crying and hugging me. And I was I was just overwhelmed. And they literally said, no one knew we were here until you. So it's a mixed bag. You can feel good about it. You can feel bad about it. But there are certain restaurants. And the Thai restaurant in San Francisco
It's a Thai restaurant. We have a clue now.
That I just swore. And they're busy
Not
all
Chinese.
The time.
I was going to guess it was going to be Chinese.
Yeah, that's my favorite. But
Well, it's also San Francisco.
That's true. They're busy all the time. Uh-huh. And they certainly, I'm not sure they could get any busier. But the idea of these wonderful people that have taught me so much about Thai food and where I can just kind of be myself and, no one bothers me and, that the idea that I would then turn it into a real, kind of tourist destination as opposed to a insider traveler recommendation.
Yeah.
I had a lot of trepidation about, and I finally, for years I've shot tons of shows in San Francisco and I've never included this restaurant. Huh. And so in the San Francisco episode and I talk right to the viewer in this episode all the time, I'm crossing the street as the camera's on me. Almost got hit actually by a car. But, I tell people, I was never going to divulge this, but, here goes.
Wow.
And so we'll see what happens there next time I get there, whether they're mad at me or they're happy with me.
Well, before we go, do you have a favorite comfort food?
Oh, gosh. I eat my grandmother. I make her roast chicken recipe.
Okay.
It's the, I could eat roast chicken three nights a week.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just that, with a pan gravy made with the little brown bits of onions and chicken fat that caramelize in the bottom of that pan. And it doesn't matter whether I have it with homemade stuffing or mashed potatoes or I just, chicken and gravy, roast chicken and gravy, when it's done right, is heavenly to me. And I've found incredible versions of that, my grandmother's, comfort food classic in Medellin, Colombia, in Driven by Food.
Oh, interesting.
In Bizarre Foods when we went to Havana.
Simply cooked chicken is universal.
It's
isn't
universal.
It?
French grandmother, Gregory Marchand at Frenchie's does a version of it in Paris on Rue de Nil that's breathtakingly delicious. There's so many countries do it. Even the huli huli chicken that's sold on the, roadsides of Hawaii as you're driving around. Roast chicken to me is just, when the skin is right, when the bird is good, is as yummy as food gets. So that's the thing that the other thing I do is meal in a bowl stuff. My freezer is loaded with quarts of I merged my grandmother's pot roast and brisket techniques with her borscht.
Oh, really?
Because she always used to make her borscht.
She was Russian?
She was German Jews.
Okay.
But we have, if you go back a couple generations, there's some Russian, other Eastern European.
Okay.
But she made a beet borscht with vinegar and dill, and she would use beef bones and then remove them. And if little bits of meat, were attached to those shin bones, it fell into the soup,
oh,
and so be it. It was fantastic. But I wanted it to be beefier and meatier, so now I brown and braise short ribs in the broth before adding them into the soup. And it's basically borscht with short ribs and a lot of dill and a big dollop of sour cream and horseradish on the side. And that's always in my freezer.
Well, I'm going to go eat now.
By the way, videos, shameless plug, we started this year on andrewzimmern.com a video series that I created called AZ Cooks, which people can go online to andrewzimmern.com. They can follow it on Twitter at AZ Cooks. But we're up to we're now up to, I think, 4 or 5 videos a week. Takes a while to sort of get production going on those things. We've been at it for about 9 months, and most of those dishes, you know, and we're adding all the time the foods, not that I necessarily eat in the show, which are not universally easy for everyone to access the ingredients or the techniques, but we're kind of marching through all of my favorite foods over the course of a year. I think people would like that, and several of those I just mentioned are all there. So
learn from the master, folks. And again, don't miss the Zimmern List on Tuesdays at 9 Eastern, 8 Central on Travel Channel. Andrew, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Andrew Zimmern for coming on the podcast. The Zimmern List airs on Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on the Travel Channel. To learn more, visit travelchannel.com. You can also check out lots of other cool stuff at andrewzimmern.com. That's Z-I-M-M-E-R-N. And follow Andrew on Twitter at Andrew Zimmern. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kickass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.